Welcome to the Protectors. What's going on, brother? How you doing?
Good, man. Doing well, man. I appreciate you having me on. I know we had to move the schedule around a few times, mostly on my end with my crazy life. So I appreciate you having me on, man. I love the show.
Scheduling is one of the best things with podcasting, is trying to fit everybody's schedule into one time where you can sit down for a few minutes. But I appreciate you coming on, man. I really appreciate you sending me your book. We're going to be talking about Legion Rising today. Surviving combat and the scars it left behind. Now, the first thing is, you wanted to be a Navy SEAL, brother? Come on. This book would have been out a lot longer ago if you were a Navy SEAL, I should say.
Come on, man. I'm a product of the 80s and early 90s, man. All it took was Charlie Sheen and reading all the Dick Marcinko books way back when. And young kid growing up on the beach down in Florida, man. It seemed like the right fit at the time.
I tell you, man, back then there was nothing. The only thing you could find in the Army was like the LERP books, the Long Range Recon Patrol books. The only ones out there were like the Marcinko, the Red Cell, and, you know, creating SEAL Team 6. So, yeah, I can see you trying to get into that, especially growing up on a beach, man. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually had the good fortune. So one of the guys that was one of the first hand-picked guys by Marcinko for SEAL Team 6 and Red Cell was down where I'm from. And my buddy's dad, who had been a SEAL, he introduced me to him kind of at a young age. So that was another pretty powerful influence and motivation. Awesome guy.
Yeah. You know, reading, everybody out there, pick up the book, Legion Rising. You know, you could head on over to Amazon or anything right now, pick it up. Cause there's some funny, I'm going to give a little spoiler alert here. In the beginning of the book, Jeff decides that he wants to figure out what chafing is like and to get toughened up for chafing, as far as like sand in the shorts and everything. And I'm reading that and I'm like, oh God, you're such a kid. You're like me, man. Like when you're a kid, you just don't know.
10 foot and bulletproof, man. It made sense at the time.
It does, man. You know, when I showed up to Army basic training, it was the 90s too. It was like 93. And I remember telling people, don't shine your boots, man. Snipers, you can't shine your boots because snipers will see your boots are shiny. I'm like, what the hell am I thinking? I was thinking way outside the box back then. And here these people are like, you know, shining their boots. They look like mirrors. And I'm like, behind a power curve there, man. Yeah, I can understand. Like, so the Navy SEALs didn't quite work out, you know, and people don't realize, like, back in the Cold War era, it wasn't as easy to get a soft spot or something in the special operations community. And Navy SEALs was one of those things where, hey, you know what? You had to go down. You had to wait for a slot. You had to do a little quick pre-selection. So the Navy SEALs, man, did you ever think back saying, hey, you know what? Maybe I should give it another try. Or once you got a taste of the Army, you were in.
No, I mean, you know, I think like anybody, there's always that side of you that's going to wonder, you know, if I've done it, you know, just like with Ranger School or SF, once I went into the Army. But like you said, you know, it just wasn't in the cards back then. I was a naive 21, 22-year-old kid, didn't have any military experience in my family. I thought I had a degree, was in good shape, could run, swim. You know, I'd go down to the Navy recruiter's office and they would welcome me with open arms to go be a SEAL officer. And the guy flat out told me the first day, he's like, man, they don't take guys like you off the street. But again, I thought I would try it out. And sure enough, the first year they came back and said, you didn't get selected. So I said, all right, I'll train harder and do better on my little SEAL PT test, which really wasn't that hard. You know, get some better recommendation letters. And, you know, and that's when I started having the shoulder issues from playing ball in college. And after a couple of surgeries, you know, it wasn't just the Navy. I went next door and talked to the Marines and Army, and they said, nah, man, we're not taking you with reconstructive surgery. So yeah, man, thought the dream was dead and left Florida, moved out to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, started a career, and then 9/11 happened. And so I was about a year removed from the last surgery, and I figured I had to give it one more shot. And amazingly, you know, post 9/11, they were taking anybody. You know, at this point, I just felt, having gone through that experience with the Navy, you know, everybody's biggest fear, if you want to be a SEAL and you don't hack it, you know, you end up on a boat for six months. And I didn't want that. And I knew I wanted something where I at least had a guaranteed chance to go into infantry and some kind of combat arms. And the Army was the only one that was willing to give that to me. So, and that's how I ended up in the Army.
I like this part of the book. This is one of my favorite parts so far. I'm halfway, I'm page 69 through the book. Right. I'm getting there. But this reminds me so much of basic training. And if everybody out there is in basic training, boot camp, or wherever school you went through, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. There were a lot of colorful characters as well, like the strange kid who bunked above me. One night we heard a noise and pop up to see what it was. Well, we found him biting his toenails. I found that both strange and disturbing. Then there was a guy assigned to me, my battle buddy. We were barely a few days in a training, and I only just met him when I was called in with the chaplain's office. There I sat in shock, listening to him explain that he was a pagan and believed in a pagan god, Gita. He stated that Gita was all about peace and wouldn't participate in things he might be doing in combat situations, which made him a conscientious objector. There are so many colorful characters. And like you said, like, you know, if you come from, like I was middle to lower class growing up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the people that show up in basic training have nothing. Yeah. One of the guys I went to basic training with, all he had was a set of PTs that the recruiter gave him. Didn't bathe in weeks. And I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, a lot of people join the military as a way out. And then when they get there, they're like, ooh, maybe this isn't for me. So you have like the pagan, the conscientious objector, the quasi-suicide attempts, the real suicide attempts. And then you always have that colorful character, man. Biting your toenails. My battle buddy ended up getting rock collections everywhere when he would take rocks off the ground and he would spread them out. And we're like, oh my gosh. So what was it like, man, leaving the colorful home you probably grew up into? Now you're being in a colorful barracks with a bunch of very interesting characters.
Yeah, it was different. It's funny. You started talking about the story and I thought you were going to bring up the young kid who came in and, you know, none of us know anybody in there. And like day one, he just stands up in front of the barracks and announces to everybody that his goal in basic training is he promised us he would jack off every single day of basic training. But yeah, you know, for me, it was a little bit different because, you know, I was 28 when I went in. You get a bear, you know, I had that period of trying to go in the Navy and then left, you know, started to, you know, call it a corporate career for a couple of years. So yeah, man, 28 years old, shipping off. And because I was going the OCS route, I had to go to basic training. So there was me and one other older guy. He was around my age. And then a bunch of 18, 19 year old kids, man. And it's frustrating as hell, but funny as hell at the same time. And just the personalities in it. You talk about people coming from nothing. I mean, my drill instructor, he asked me one day, he's like, man, I don't have time for this. So I wrote it's the first time a lot of these kids have had bank accounts. And so I had to give a class on how to write a check. And just, you know, for us, it just seems so simple. But, for me, I think it really kind of gave me that perspective of, yeah, this is training. You can laugh about it what you want. But, you know, when I get out to my unit one day, you know, this is going to be, this is the pool that those men that I lead one day are going to come from. And some are going to come from great backgrounds. Some are going to come from nothing. You know, and my job as the leader of that group to, you know, not only learn from the NCOs, but also be able to offer some guidance and mentorship for those that maybe didn't come from quite such, I don't know, call it fortunate as the rest of us.
Now, I think that's an excellent opportunity for, you know, I was enlisted, then I did ROTC. And a lot of the ROTC guys and girls that I went through with don't have that experience. They don't have the basic training experience unless they were like simultaneous membership. So they would go through like National Guard or Reserve component, go through basic training, then come back out and finish ROTC. I didn't really run into a lot of OCS candidates and officers till I went to OBC, which was September 2001, you know, right around that time frame. So it was kind of interesting to see a lot of the enlisted guys and girls, well, not girls because I was infantry at the time, they didn't have girls. And it was real interesting to see a lot of this perspective of, you know, them going through basic training, then boom, they're right in IOBC, you know, boom, OCS and IOBC. So it was like this huge time pipeline. Yeah. So you graduate basic training. Do you go right on to OCS right from there? Or is there like any leeway or there's no unit?
Yeah, I graduated right before Christmas break. So I had a 3-week break between basic training and OCS. Yeah, it went pretty quick.
So what did it feel like to go to OCS right after basic training? Was it like basic training all over again?
Oh, it was so stupid, man. It was, I tell people all the time, man, that was the dumbest 14 weeks of my life. The hardest part about it is, I think you've got through that part of the book where there's me and several guys that I went to basic with that were all going to OCS. We all hooked up a few days before and drove down to Benny together. And the night before, we all got food poisoning. And so just, you know, both ends, man, the night before, and then having to show up there at 4:30 and take a PT test. One of my four buddies, I mean, just, you know, on the sit-ups, man, just freaking squirted.
Oh, God.
So that was the worst part. But, you know, for me, the school itself was not challenging. It was, I mean, I get they got to do what they got to do. I'm not going to be critical of it, mm-hmm. but I was very fortunate that my roommate was a prior service enlisted E6, prior Ranger back guy. And then the guys that we shared a bathroom and shower with, one was a prior service E7 SF guy, and the other was an E8. He was one of those dudes that had made eight and eight years, just sharp as hell, man. So I had the good fortune of, you know, mentors like that to sit me down and be like, Jeff, you know, this school is a freaking joke. You know, don't take anything seriously.
Yeah, just take a chill pill, basically, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I learned more from those guys just sitting around the room at night or out in the field, just picking their brains of what the real Army was going to be like. So I was incredibly fortunate in that regard.
Now, you know, we're going to fast forward a little bit until you get your first combat deployment. And this is something you're probably anticipating, something you've been thinking about almost all your life, thinking, hey, you know what? First, I want to be a Navy SEAL because I know I want to get, you know, some direct action. I want to do some ops. Next thing you know, now you're in a leadership position and you're overseas and you're in Baghdad and you get your first contact. I'm going to talk about this right here. It says, this is your first, as you call it, you're losing your combat virginity. My heart still thudded rapidly as I tried to take in what had just happened. My combat virginity had just been lost in a matter of seconds, and I was scared shitless. All the training in the world can't fully prepare you for what it feels like to see guns firing at you, to experience the nearness of an RPG, and to witness the hatred and power of an opposing human force who wants nothing more than to see your blood spilled on the street. So that must have been like a hell of a wake-up call. Seeing as you aren't a young kid, you're not just a basic training kid out of high school, your eyes are glazed over, you're an adult, you've had a career, and now you're in combat. What is going through your mind at that point?
I mean, honestly, I mean, exactly what you just read. I mean, it's, I never, you know, people ask all the time, and I'm sure you've gotten as well of like, you know, what's it like? And I tell everybody all the time, I'm like, man, I was scared shitless the first time. I mean, there's nothing natural about that situation. You can train for it. You can try to mentally discipline yourself that these things are going to come. But, you know, it's the whole fight or flight. You know, no one knows until you're in that scenario. And I'm very open, you know, myself and, you know, not just myself, but, you know, most of the guys in the platoon, we all froze. Like, no one returned fire. I mean, again, it was a split second thing. Some guys popped around a corner, you know, shot some rounds, an RPG went in between two of our Bradleys. So, you know, it was really over before we had a chance to return fire. But, you know, what it taught us, I think the lesson learned from that was the anticipation of that instead of waiting to be reactive, you know, to pay more attention to the surroundings, you know, and like anything, you get more accustomed to it, you get some experience and you start looking for opportunities for when and where those things can come from. You know, so I think the initial shock of it was, you know, like, holy shit, man, this is the real deal. But quickly, and again, I had great NCOs in my platoon that we all sat down and, you know, we didn't sugarcoat anything. We were pretty tough on ourselves and really used it as a great learning opportunity for, you know, not just if, but when it was going to happen again.
Yeah, exactly. Especially, you know, the Army deployments are a lot longer than most service branches. I'd say they are the longest. And to know you're going to be experiencing combat again and to know that it's just a little glimpse of what you may see. And I'm sure as I get through the rest of the pages, I'm going to see a lot more of that. But, you know, there was an aspect later on where you're talking about when you fire back at the enemy and you're fire, you don't really think at first about where your bullets are going to end up. And that is one thing that, you know, in the law enforcement world, military world, anywhere where you're shooting projectiles in one direction, you never know where they're going to end up. And that must have been like another wake up call, another like, huh, yeah. So, you know, now when you're planning your missions, now when you're doing everything, you have to think of the bigger picture. So how does your leadership progress from initially beginning to, you know, you're relying on your NCOs to actually taking charge?
You know, I think it was exactly what you just said is, you know, everybody talks about, you know, both in the military and in the corporate world, you know, surround yourself with good people and empower them to do their job. When oftentimes, you know, I've been around enough leaders that what they really mean is, let me surround myself with enough people that are going to do what I tell them to do because it makes me look good. And, you know, for me, you know, I'd really like to think and take pride in doing the former, that it was, you know, let me be the one that's thinking about that situational awareness of, for the instance you're talking about of, yeah, hey, cool, we killed the first bad guy, but guess what? If we would have missed, you know, that 25 Mike HE round probably would have landed on our FOB. You know, so my job was to, you know, to plan, to think about the other contingencies, but also trust my men. And, you know, you can't be everywhere at once. And these guys had a lot more experience than I'll be, you know, not necessarily in combat, you know, just experience in the military, training events, different things they had done. And so when those things happened, to rely on them, and when they made decisions, to trust them and support them, not be afraid to step in if need be, but you can count on one hand how many times I had to do that. So it really was just trying to foster that environment of empowerment. And
empowerment is one of my favorite words. It's one of my favorite leadership and strategies, and anything I ever do, I want to empower other people to kind of be like the top of their game. And that's what you're doing as a leader. That's what you should be doing as a leader. Mm-hmm. You know, the guys and girls who aren't going to make it past major, you know, the ones that aren't going to make it past like GS 13, 14 in the government, is because they don't do those self empowerment, the self-glorification, the there is no word called selfless service to them. And I'm not bashing on it. I mean, there's just people that are really more career-minded than the rest of the quality leadership out there. Was that one of the reasons you kind of stepped away from the military?
It was, especially, and I know you haven't got there yet, but, you know, my first deployment really felt like, you know, we had a task and purpose to what we were doing. I was empowered by my leadership to go out and make decisions and lead my men. And then, you know, times change, and look, I'm not naive. I mean, I'm a big kid. I realize there's bigger things at play in the grand scheme of things, but yeah, that second deployment was just much more, you know, call it, you know, political, corporate, whatever it may be. And I just saw myself, you know, at the level I was at, you know, the next thing, I was fortunate. I got command, you know, I took command as a first lieutenant. And, you know, so because, yeah, that was great. I got to go back with these same group of guys for a second deployment. You know, I had about 10 years of staff time, you know, staring me in the face after that. Yeah, I may get a second HAC command, but that's not really out, you know, leading men and women how, you know, for at least not what I signed up to do. And yeah, I just started to see that side of it. And, you know, we always laugh. We're like, you know, there's, you know, you talk the major level. We always kind of kid it around, and, you know, sorry for any majors listening out there. Like, you know, whatever it is, man, you must go to that CGSC or whatever it is. And like the first thing they do is, because, you know, all those lieutenants and captains, you know, you talk about, man, when I get there, I'm not going to say that stuff. I'm not going to be a yes man. I'm going to think for, you know, look out for the troops and do what we know is right. And then all of a sudden it's like you become a major and you get this frontal lobotomy, man, where like all those things you used to talk about, and you kind of become part of the institution. And I get it. You know, the Army is an institution. The military as itself is. And there's a certain level of corporate governance that has to be a part of that. I'm not criticizing it. I just didn't want to be a part of it. And so I made the decision to walk away.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. I call it the pat on the back. Someone pats you on the back, whether they're a colonel or a general or someone of senior rank, and you're a captain, a senior lieutenant, and they go, you know what? If you don't fuck up, you're going to move up. And from that point, the seed is planted in the back of your head. And I think, you know, once you get that staff job, you're like, huh, maybe 10 years on staff isn't bad, because then I won't fuck up and I'll move up. You know, it's like, I'm not going to knock what I wanted my career to be about.
Yeah. And again, you haven't got there, but during my second deployment, we were getting our ass handed to us, man. And the assistant division commander was coming out to visit our base. This was after I had lost all those guys and just wanted to check in on us. And so the brigade DCO came out, because I had to, you know, I had to give him my brief before I could give the two-star the brief. And I gave it to him, and, you know, I didn't sugarcoat it. I told him what the situation on the ground was, and he looked at me and he said, "You can't tell him that." And this is a lieutenant colonel. And again, I'm not painting with a broad brush. There's a lot of great mm-hmm. lieutenant colonels out there, but this always stuck with me. And I just said, well, sir, you know, that's the situation on the ground. And he just said, well, you need to tell him something else. And I said, sir, are you asking me to lie? He said, you can put whatever term you want behind it, but you can't tell him what you just told me. That's an order.
Wow.
So I told the general exactly what I told him and proceeded to get my ass handed to me by not only him, but the brigade commander. But, you know, it's not something I wanted to be a part of.
Well, I'm glad you took the stand. You know, I'm glad you took the stand. You're here to talk about it today. I'm glad you put it on paper, because now I'm definitely going to read the rest of the book tonight or tomorrow. Usually I kind of spread these things out, but man, I'm really engrossed in it. And I'm on page 69, like I said, everybody out there. And you got to get it. Legion Rising, Surviving Combat, and The Scars Left Behind by Jeff Morris. Because it's a great book. And it's going on my awesome shelf over here with all the other great authors. So how long, when you got back from the war, did it take you to say, hey, you know what? It's not about me. It's about telling the stories of those that I lost and telling the stories for future generations. We know that there's a ton of books about, I joke about the Navy SEALs, but there are a ton of Navy SEALs books. There's a ton of soft books. There's a ton of books about specialized units. But the ground truth books, there's not a lot of them out there as far as how many hundreds of thousands of us have deployed. So how far out was it, and why did you start writing the book?
So, yeah, and I'll give the clip notes here. It's in the interest of time. So, you know, I came back, man.
We got plenty of time, brother.
Yeah. I had five tough years, you know, when I got back, and you'll get into it. I mean, you read the prologue of the book, that scene of me in the mirror, you know, and that messed me up in the head pretty bad, you know, cut myself open with, you know, pieces of another man's skull, you know, one of my men who had been shot, you know, and then just the survivor's guilt, you know, you can think about it however you want, but, you know, you make decisions and men die from those decisions. Now, I can be objective and say, you know, I made 99 other decisions that more than likely probably helped save somebody's ass. You know, but just the way we're wired, you think about the ones when things didn't work out, and swapping seats with a guy in a Humvee, and the last minute, you know, hour and a half later, he's dead. I'm still here. So, yeah, man, I came back, just went into a hole for 5 years, you know, got divorced, you know, on paper, looked good, got a good job, making good money, and put the act on 9 to 5, and just really was just a shell of who I was. So it's 5 years after that is when I finally started, you know, kind of got a, I always say my mom, you know, bitch slapped me and kind of got me back to being me, or at least taking the steps to do that. And so it started with sharing the story with some friends of mine. And we created, I was really into doing CrossFit at the time. And so we created a hero wad, you know, workout of the day. And our unit nickname, that second deployment, was Legion. This is one of our old shirts here. And so we just came up with this workout, just thought it would be kind of a one-time deal. And the response was incredible. So the next year, multiple gyms did it. You know, this started in 2012. You know, just every year, more and more gyms around the country were doing it. And I was going, and I was always, you know, giving speeches and presentations. But it was never about me. It was always about the men, and this eight men, and this, you know, collective group of Legion and what we had been through together. You know, and through that, seeing the impact that it was having on not just veterans, but non-veterans, of us getting up and just being open about tragedy and trauma, they don't discriminate, and PTSD, you know, it's not exclusive to the military, and how seeing the story of these men, how it was resonating with people from all walks of life, and, you know, helping them develop and taking the necessary steps in their life to make meaningful change. And it was powerful. It was really powerful. But I never thought of anything how that related to me personally. It was always about the men. And then from that, people started approaching me more and more, you know, well, hey, we want to hear your side of this. You know, you're always talking about them. Let's hear you. So that led to me kind of talking more and more. And then coming back full circle to your point, I can't tell you how many people are like, you know, man, you need to share this story, because all I ever read about stuff like this is the SEALs, you know, and the SF guys and the soft community. And again, those guys are awesome, man. I'm not here to take away from it. He's like, but, you know, for every one of them, there's 100 of you, and there's more stories like that. And I think from a standpoint of being able to relate, you know, look, man, I got a lot of buddies in the soft community. I'm sure you do as well. And they'll be the first to tell you, like, they're the most, hey, I'm just an average dude, man. But society in general, I think, kind of puts them on a pedestal. I'm like, man, I'm not like that guy. He's larger than life. But they look at someone like me, who was just a regular conventional infantry guy, and that's someone they can relate to. And again, so seeing the impact of that and what it was having on people, you know, the standpoint of relating and just saying, you know what, if he can do it, if he can overcome these things, then so can I. And so, yeah, it took a while. I mean, it, you know, gosh, it was 2008. I left active duty. So it was 2017 when I started working on the book, and it was published a couple of years after that.
Yeah. The, you know, the book is really good, and I see a lot of similarities in like your leadership style, the way you grew up, with a lot of different people, myself included, that I've encountered throughout. It's always about helping someone else. It's always about something else bigger than just that one thing. And it's not about self-glorification, and people have to understand, like, you could write a book all about self-glorification, but this book isn't it. This book isn't like, hey, you know what? I'm the best thing ever that happened since sliced bread. It's not. It's a great book about this is a man who wanted to do something better. And especially after the post 9/11 thing, that always gets me, man, because I was a Cold War guy and then I got recalled post 9/11. And I can see the difference in the styles of leadership and the styles of people who were joining in the 90s and the post 9/11 generation. So I really commend you for everything you've done. I commend you for writing this book, brother. What's next up? What's the next book?
I don't know, man. You know, it's, I get asked that a lot, and, you know, honestly, I mean, and I have some ideas on what to do with that, but you just did some advice from some other people. I don't think I'm done with this one yet. I really don't. I think there's, you know, so my agent, you know, you know the whole process of having to go through this. I mean, a lot of it's luck and who you know. And I was very fortunate and got this incredible agent who doesn't like his name out there a whole lot. But, you know, this guy's, why in the hell he picked me, I have no idea. But he told me, he was just like, you know, Jeff, this is, and these are his words, not mine. So again, back to the glorification, that's a sliced bread. I'm not saying that at all. He's like, Jeff, I've been in this space a while. This is, you know, one of the top five I've ever, you know, just from some of the reasons you just mentioned. And I had an incredible co-writer, by the way. So again, I'm not giving myself any of the credit here. He said, the issue is going to come down to, and he was real blunt with me. He was like, nobody knows who the hell you are. And, you know, and he's like, that's what we have to overcome. He's like, so this may be a long process. We went to all the big publishing house. We made it to the pub board for, you know, the big five. We made it to the pub board for four of the five. And every one of them, awesome book. We loved it. I don't think we can sell it because no one's heard of this guy. And I get it, you know, that's fair. Yeah. I wasn't a soft guy. And, you know, so, but what can I do to change that? You know, instead of just moving on to the next thing, is just get out and keep talking about it. Because again, I think you're seeing that the book is not about me. I mean, yeah, the central figure, and it's told through my eyes. But, you know, the book is about this collective group of men over two deployments, these incredibly difficult circumstances that we went through. The ability to rise above those, albeit it wasn't an easy process and it's still ongoing. I mean, we had our most recent suicide just 3 years ago, you know, 10 years post removed from these events. So it's not going away, you know, but just trying to set that example of, you know, it is possible to take something bad and turn it into something good and use that platform. And albeit it's one we didn't ask for, but it's one that life handed us. You know, so what are we going to do with it? So I don't want to move on to the next thing until I can go to sleep at night and say, you know what, I've done everything I can with Legion Rising and this message, because it's really, it's not a story, it's a message. And I think there's a broader platform and broader audience that needs to hear this message.
Well, you know, I should say the next thing up for you is using your voice and spreading the message. You've written it. Now talk about it. And that's why I'm glad to have you on at Protectors. So let's give a big shout out to Lauren Mickler. She is the co-author. She's an author, freelance writer, and traveler. She lives in Texas with her husband and three children. Thank you, Lauren Mickler.
So yeah, it's pretty, just real quick side story on that.
Yeah, so sure, go ahead.
She had, so the gym where we started the CrossFit workout, the people sold it, and these new owners brought it in. And I had moved away from Tyler, Texas at this point over to Dallas. And the new owners called and said, hey, we want to keep doing the Legion 8 workout over here, but a lot of our new members don't know about it. My daughter, you know, young 20-something-year-old woman, aspiring writer, can she just do a little blog on you? So never met her, talked for 2 hours. She writes this blog, and I'm like, man, for whatever reason, she just gets it. And So that was kind of the extent of our relationship. And so I really started getting serious about the book. I talked to some other people and had some more established authors who were interested in taking on the project. And for whatever reason, man, I was just drawn back to her and how she was able to kind of capture the essence of what it's not the story, it's the message behind what we're trying to do. So I reached out to her, and people are shocked when they find out. So that, you know, this is the first book she's ever been a part of. And it's been really neat to see. I mean, she had a full-time career, mom of three, but, you know, Legion Rising, you know, it's, you know, not some New York Times bestseller, but it's done well and it's gotten her name out there and it's opened up other doors for her. So here we are, I guess, what, you know, 2017 we started. Now here we are just over 4 years since we first began, and she's on her sixth or seventh book now.
Wow.
She's traveling the world with her family. If you want a cool follow on Instagram, just LC Mickler. And so basically her and her husband, her family are just living abroad, and every couple of months they move to a different part of the world, and she continues to write and take on new projects. It's pretty awesome to see how this has helped launch her career as well.
That's where it's at, brother. And I'm going to invite you both to come on to the Protectors Book Club. So if everybody's out there doesn't realize that there is a book club called the Protectors Book Club, and we bring on awesome authors. We talk about books and writing style. And I really want to get into helping others in our community get out there and put their words to paper, because everybody has a voice, and you don't have to be a New York Times bestseller. You don't have to have a huge Instagram follow. You could publish these things and get the word out there. So you are both absolutely, I'd be honored to have you both on, and I'd be honored to have you on if Lauren can't make it, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Brother.
No, I'd love to, man. I love what you're doing that. Cause again, it's about, there's so many great stories out there, and so many people, I think, just give up because it's hard. I was fortunate to have some people to kind of guide us along the way. And Lauren had some people from her world of this, you know, aspiring young women writers group that she had, I'm butchering the name, but whatever, she had been accepted in years ago, you know, so we were fortunate that we had enough mentorship to kind of help us navigate the process, but a lot of people don't. And I think the more people get out through platforms mm-hmm. like the book club and talk about it, you know, there's going to be some kid, you know, listening is going to hear that, and it's going to help kind of, you know, in some small way, maybe we can help them navigate the waters.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, like you said before, she started blogging. Blogging has not gone away. Yeah. I do it and write op-eds, man. That's my new passion, is like, until I get my next book off the ground, is I've been doing op-eds all the time. But I tell people, write. Get your voice out there. You don't have to write the book right away. You can write a 1,000-page op-ed. I mean, 1,000-word op-ed. You could write a blog. You could start a website. Do something. Just write. Write a 240-character Twitter post. But think about it. You know, yeah. Anything. Just write, edit later. That's my mantra.
Yep. I think she would, again, she handled the lion's share of the, it was a lot of me talking, a lot of her writing, and a lot of me going back and writing and putting, you know, kind of my twist and my personality into it. But she used to say the same thing. She's like, I would just write for hours and then go back later to edit it.
Well, everybody, make sure you pick up Legion Rising, Surviving Combat and the Scars It Left Behind by Jeff Morris with LC Mickler. It's available now everywhere you can buy books. And also look and follow Jeff on all social media platforms and everything he's doing, because he's got big things going. And now we got to follow LC and see her travels throughout the world with her family. I just followed her on Instagram because I can multitask. Okay. And I'm like, man, must be nice. I need to go on trips. Brother, you're always welcome. Yeah. Come back on the show.
Yeah. Hey, brother, man, I appreciate the opportunity, the platform. Love the show. You know, this world is kind of small, stumbled across it, late to the game, albeit. And oh, man, I was so late to like the Instagram. I did a horrible job marketing the book. I think a year ago I had like, you know, 50 Instagram followers. Not that I have a whole lot now. I just didn't do much with it. But yeah, man, stumbled across it and just started, you know, and guys that I follow or been on other podcasts, you know, and I started seeing a lot of the same names, and I'm like, holy shit, man, look at this guest list, you know? So that's why I kind of gave you the, hey, would you be interested in a nobody like me? But I appreciate the opportunity.
Everybody, man, there is, yeah. I don't care if you have one Instagram follower or whatever. I just want to hear good stories, man.
Yeah. No, man, keep it up. I love it.